So okay. Go ahead and start?
Yes. Okay, it is November 2nd, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. John Mack, CEO of Morgan Stanley. Mr. Mack, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. My name is Chris Seifer. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009, which tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis, deliver a report to Congress by the end of this year. We certainly thought it made a lot of sense to talk to you, given your position with Morgan Stanley and the fact that you lived through the crisis. So with that, as we discussed before I turned on the recording device, could you please summarize your education and work background, starting with college?
Sure. First of all, I'm chairman of Morgan Stanley. I'm no longer CEO, and that change took place in December of last year.
Thank you for that correction.
So college, Duke University, 4.5 years, athletic scholarship. Worked also at a small brokerage firm called First Securities in North Carolina when I was in school. And then in 1968, joined Smith Barney, and over a five-year period, worked at Smith Barney, worked at Loeb Rhodes, F.S. Smithers, and then ended up at Morgan Stanley in 1972. In 1972, Morgan Stanley was a partnership. About 350 people. They were beginning to get into the capital markets area in the sales and trading capacity. I joined in the fixed income group, and then over the course of, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, became a partner, and then the firm grew, and as the firm grew, I was lucky enough to grow with it, and left Morgan Stanley in 2001, and didn't do anything for 4 or 5 months. And then was recruited by Credit Suisse to run their global investment bank, Credit Suisse First Boston, which I did for 3 years. And then after that, they did not renew my contract. I was not liked by the Swiss. And I ended up really working with a hedge fund, Art Sandberg, a Pequot, and was there for not quite a year before I was called by a search firm, but I think about returning to Morgan Stanley, I think in 2005. And I've been here ever since.
Okay. So remind me, when did Morgan Stanley go public?
1986.
Okay, so that's when you were still there. As you... can you tell me... How, if at all, did the business change when it went from a partnership to a public company? As you may recall, when you testified at our hearing in January, there was a panel that followed you that included Mr. Solomon, and he and others have been telling us that one of the things they see as issues in the financial crisis is that investment banks transfer from partnerships to corporations. Can you give us your views on that?
Well, number one, you have to understand why did we go public? And the reason, and there'll be a conversation, I'm sure, today about leverage.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that the leverage, because the business was expanding so rapidly, both domestically and internationally, that I think at one point our leverage was close in 1/4, 60-1. So we knew we had to raise equity. And that's what drove us to do a public offering. You know, I don't think, as far as culture-wise, I don't think becoming a public company changed the nature and the way we did business. I think what changed the business format was the amount of risk-taking that evolved over the next, you know, 15 years, 10 years. I mean, when Morgan Stanley... even after being a public company, if we were long a position, it was by accident. I mean, everything was an agency transaction. There was very little demands where you had to put up capital. To my knowledge, I never recall doing a bought deal in the first 5 or 6 or even 10 years after being public. So I don't think going from a partnership to a public company, at least my perception is, changed dramatically either risk-taking or risk.
So why do you think after the ballpark 10-year time frame after going public that Morgan Stanley started increasing its risk-taking?
Because, number one, there was competition. And when competition will go to, a Duke Power, I'm using this as an example, who needs to raise a round of equity, and someone, or let's say not equity, let's do fixed income, and some competitor is willing to do a bought deal. In other words, they will buy the deals back then were not that large. Let's say it's $500 million. That's certainty for the issuer. And to be in the business, then we needed to use our capital to show clients that we would do bought deals. So it was an evolution of risk-taking that happened over time, but not about, if we'd have been a partnership, we'd have done the same thing. And I think Goldman Sachs is proof of that. If you go back, I think they became public in 1998 or 1999. Mm-hmm. They were doing bought deals as a partnership.
Mm-hmm. What about, I don't have the trend analysis on your segments in front of me, but I think Morgan Stanley, like the other investment banks, after going public, although given how early you guys went public, maybe not right away, a lot more of the business over time ended up going into the trading operation as opposed to the more traditional and investment banking type businesses. Did that in fact incur at Morgan Stanley, and if so, why?
A lot more of the business. You mean products or revenues? I'm a little confused.
Yeah, definitely the latter on revenues, pre-tax earnings, etc.
Well, the answer to that is yes, because you had a combination of things going on. Number one, globalization was a huge force in the capital markets area. And whether it's the growth of countries around the world who are much more active, either in raising debt or investing pension money. Let's take the pension plans in the UK, or you can go to the Japanese Postal Authority. There was a lot more global business of investing. And then the activity level, you had and I guess this probably happened sometime in the 80s, the creation of long-short fund managers created more volume. So, I think the revenues coming to the capital markets or the sales and trading side was really driven by a number of factors, and one of them being, as I said, globalization. Number two, I think there was a shift in asset management to much more active trading. And number three, there was creation of this long-short hedge fund, which created more activity. And then just to put the icing on the cake, you could put in the whole emergence that began to come from the emerging markets, the activity in that. So your sales and trading businesses grew at a much faster rate into sales and trading versus banking. So if you go back to when I first started the business at Morgan Stanley in 1972, the state of Florida pension fund would not buy World Bank bonds because in Turkey, where World Bank was giving them money to the farmers, they were growing tobacco and cotton, competing with states like Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, South Carolina. They did no trading. It was buy and hold. So over the course of not just since Morgan Stanley became a public company, but over the course of 30 years, these pension funds determined that buy and hold was not the right strategy, that active management created, I guess they call it alpha today, but better returns. So you had a real growth in the sales and trading businesses, primarily driven by active management.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's get to the markets in 2007. But before we get there, since you came back to Morgan Stanley in 2005, tell me how you found the company in 2005 and what your strategy was for running the company once you got there, and in particular, what changes you made, if any.
Well, I found a company that clearly were going through some political issues internally. Morale was down. It slipped in most of the league tables. and was continuing to lose large numbers of people. And one of the things that Morgan had not been very aggressive in is in the financing, most specifically of the private equity areas and leverage finance. Even though the firm had probably, if not the best, one of the best M&A departments on the street. So what I found was a great franchise that needed to be energized and focus on building up its businesses, both in investment banking globally and sales and trading globally, and being more active with some of the accounts, hedge funds, private equity firms, and active managers.
And what about positions in real estate?
Be a little more specific than that.
Was the company? Did the company have positions in real estate?
Well, the company had a very large private equity real estate, MESREF, as it's called, Morgan Stanley Real Estate Fund. So that was large. I don't recall offhand how large, but it had to be one of the larger ones. And the company was involved in the mortgage securitized product and mortgage trading. I don't recall in 05, was it any larger or any smaller than Credit Suisse, but I would say we were one of the major firms that would not be considered a top firm in the mortgage area. Mm-hmm. Top firm meaning in terms of volume.
Right. Now, we know from looking at the documents that, you know, eventually in 06 you purchased Saxon, and of course the following, and at the end of 07 you took the big hit on the ABS CDO positions, I believe.
Right.
So was when after you got there in 05, was the real estate business, whether in terms of the securitization business or the retained business, increased or changed in any way?
Oh, it increased. I mean, I think one of the things that people talked about when I returned, and one of the reasons, you know, we bought Saxon, which was one of the smaller firms. We actually had looked at some firms much larger. I think it's called New Century was the one we looked at. And thought it was too big and that we shouldn't go forward as a big discussion at the board. But we felt that we needed an issuer servicer / servicer to make sure we had a supply of mortgage paper that we could securitize. So that was one of the things we talked about, and that's one of the reasons we bought Saxon.
Mm-hmm. And then understanding Saxon's purchased for the securitization business, what about decisions on retaining real estate positions?
Well, Saxon was bought for securitization and for servicing. We thought that was important. So the second part of your question was what? I'm sorry?
Just the retained positions. Like I said, you know, we know that unfortunately, you know, Morgan took the big hit in 4Q07. So I'm just wondering about the decisions that, you know, led to those positions being retained in the first place.
Well, that was an analysis that, I mean, clearly you could say it was flawed, but we looked at that trade, and in the early on in that transaction, it was a huge revenue generator. And then as the market began to the change in I guess in early 07, our short position, basically we were short the market. We thought that we had a good trade on. We did a lot of analysis, did not think that some of the things that happened would happen. And because of the nature of some of the trades, as the market got worse, we got longer, looked at the trade mid 07, and still made the judgment that the mortgage market would not be as severe as it ended up being. So it was clearly a miscalculation in judgment, but we were not alone. I think everyone made that, almost everyone made that same mistake.
And more generally, or at least not specific to that particular trade that led to the write-off in 4Q07, when did Morgan Stanley start to see cracks in the housing market? And
I would say in the end of the second quarter of 07.
And what were the signs that, that you folks were seeing?
Well, the default rates were going up, and people were walking away from their homes.
Prior to that, I mean, what kind of metrics were was Morgan Stanley looking at? I mean, was it looking at, you know, home price appreciation by geographic area, MSA? Obviously, it sounds like you guys were looking at delinquencies and you know, charge-offs and foreclosures and that kind of stuff. But what kind of metrics was the company looking at?
Well, I would think, we really need to get one of the structuring guys in here now, but I would think we're looking at some of the public data on housing. And we were also doing, I'm sure if we're securitizing product, we were looking at slices of the mortgages we were bringing in and what was the history on those products. So it was the standard data that we got as an industry participant.
Mm-hmm. And can you just walk us through how the housing market was changing after you saw those first stresses in mid-07?
How the housing market was changing.
How it was impacting the company.
Well, if it wasn't for this trade, it wouldn't have had that much impact if we were on the other side of it. Part of the issue on this trade is that you had very little liquidity, and the only way you could get out of this trade was to negotiate a settlement or a out with the holder of the paper. So it was very cumbersome. But it really wasn't until, I would say, middle of the third quarter, you could really see that delinquencies were going up dramatically within the housing market.
What about on the funding side of the company? We've heard from several folks that the clearing banks were requiring larger haircuts on tri-party repos, that overnight investors were requiring shorter maturities, but we've heard that's happening to different firms at different times and in different degrees over time. I'm wondering what Morgan Stanley's experience was.
In that period of time, I'm not aware of those issues.
Okay, and that period?
We were getting real squeezed on the funding side by clearing banks or by customers.
Okay, and that period of time being?
I don't recall it.
Okay, and then I'm sorry, and just that period of time being 2007?
Really, I'm moving to the middle of the third quarter 2007.
Okay, and then how did things change then?
Well, things really didn't change then until you get into, I got to get my time frame straight. As you go into the fourth quarter of 07, and again, even though we took a big loss, we were still profitable for the year. What really began to change is the lenders to private equity were beginning to balk at some of the leverage that they were being given. And there was a fair amount of conversation with the banks, including Morgan Stanley, honor their commitment to fund some of these acquisitions. That, along with deterioration in the housing market and our loss, we became much more cautious, and we started lowering our leverage into the fourth quarter and into the first quarter of 08. We started taking leverage down.
Mm-hmm. And that's on the asset side. Any changes on the funding side in 4Q07 or into 1Q08?
You know, I'm sure there was, but I can't recall what it is. I need to get someone else to answer that question for you.
Okay, I appreciate that. What about, tell us what kind of impact the failure or the government-assisted acquisition of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan Chase had on Morgan Stanley?
Well, I don't think it was just Morgan Stanley. I think by the time that Bear Stearns was bought by J.P. Morgan, everyone understood that we were in a major downtrend in housing and in prices, driven by a lot of reasons. One of them is in the public sector, consumers were over-leveraged, structures were complicated. so people became more and more cautious and started trying to create more liquidity. If you go back and look at Morgan Stanley in the end of 07, after our mortgage loss, and even though we were profitable, we thought we should go raise capital, and we turned to CIC, again, I don't know, the last part of 07 or the first part of 08, we raised $5 billion in equity trying to create less leverage, which we did.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen in a lot of the documents that we've reviewed and interviews that we've taken that after Bear went down, at least the New York Fed's presence became... There was a New York Fed presence at all of the investment banks, and it sounds like, although I'm not sure, that the SEC's presence was perhaps more present, for lack of a better term. Can you describe for us how things changed in terms of government oversight after Bear Stearns?
Really, from the New York Fed, there was much more focus on funding and problems and loans. I remember saying to Tim Geithner at some social event, he was chatting, what was going on. I made the comment to him that if you've ever seen a Korean War movie where you're in a minefield and you take out your bayonet and you start probing the ground trying to find the mines, that my view was everyone on the street was taking out the bayonet trying to figure out where the problems were.
Okay. And what did the SEC's oversight under the CSE program change much at all?
No, I'd say they were fairly consistent. The Fed was the one who had the most, were asking, I think, the majority of the questions and doing most of the probing.
Mm-hmm. And
my Tipo was here, he may say something different, but from my perspective, there was much more dialogue with the Fed.
Okay, and one of the things we've seen in the documents and from interviewing folks at the Fed and others is that they started instituting liquidity stress tests that I guess were more difficult to pass, I guess, or more stress scenarios than was the case before Bear, because apparently folks were somewhat surprised that there was a run on secured financing, particular repos at Bear. Do you recall anything like that? Not that people were surprised at Bear, but that there were additional liquidity stress tests instituted after Bear?
I do not.
Okay.
I don't recall that.
Okay. What was the change, if anything, in terms of funding for Morgan Stanley following Bear, whether unsecured or secured funding?
We really didn't have an issue with funding right up until after Lehman went out of business. Now, we may have paid more money for it, but it wasn't an issue that we couldn't get funding.
What about tenors? Were they changing at all?
I'm sorry, what about?
Term. Were lenders requiring shorter terms?
Desk. But again, you need to go back to the end of 07, early 08, we raised $5 billion in equity. We began to get out of more of our less liquid assets. So we were trying to create as much liquidity as possible and at the same time run the business and compete. Terms may have changed, but no one brought anything to my attention that was outrageous, so I really can't comment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I understand that the funding issue, that there were not apparently funding issues between Bear and Lehman, but can you describe for us generally what the environment was and how you folks were changing how you were operating the company other than you've already mentioned raising additional capital?
Well, we were very focused on illiquid assets. We were focused on, problem positions. We probably, again, I don't know offhand what the leverage was, but clearly we took leverage down, and we became much more cognizant of doing business with some of our counterparties.
What was the New York Fed and other members of the Fed or other Fed offices, if the D.C. Fed was talking to you folks, what were their primary concerns?
I don't recall the D.C. Fed talking to us. It may have spoken to my CFO, but I don't think so. It was mainly the New York Fed. And I think, you know, I can't put a specific time or date, but the overall memory would be that the New York Fed was much more active in trying to ascertain problem positions, liquidity, issues like that.
Was you mentioned that you were focused more on illiquid assets, and I've seen just from the public filings that you folks were, you know, taking write-downs on leveraged loans and some residential real estate and some SIVs and even on some, apparently, some monoline hedges. Were you having trouble actually selling assets as a, you know, or was the reduced exposure primarily by through write-downs?
I'd say mainly by write-downs.
Okay. And was there problems or difficulties in selling the assets, or were you trying to sell the assets?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Okay. Explain to us what we know generally, of course, from the books and from other interviews, walk us through your involvement during Lehman Weekend.
You just want an overview, right?
To start, yes, and then I'll follow up.
Well, we were called down to the Fed on a Friday afternoon. We all show up. I was told I could bring my CFO, no one else. It was apparent that I was one of the few people that listened. Everyone else brought a bunch of people. Paulson, Bernanke, Cox, Geithner talked about that he needed the street to help put together a fund that could work with on the Lehman, let's call them bad assets, the bad bank, mm-hmm. to allow at that time a B of A to buy the good assets. And you know, there was a lot of pushback, not understanding why are we being asked to help this competitor. And Hank was very clear that he could not go back to the Congress. I don't know if it was because of Fannie and Freddie or AIG, but felt he did not have the political capital to do that, and thought the right thing to do is for the street to be supportive of one of its own. And over 2 days, 2.5 days, we actually got to that point. I don't think all the banks there participated, but clearly the U.S. banks and some of the foreign banks, I think we got up to about somewhere in the $10 billion range that we were able to raise. So that was the conversation. There was some concern that once you help Lehman, and it was said in the meeting, then what are we going to do about Merrill Lynch? That there was a view that there could be a domino effect one after another. And the leadership, either from the Fed or the Treasury, said, you know, if we can show the Congress that you have stepped up and helped Lehman, and if this continues, we think we could get help on the next one. So that was the conversation.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Paulson said, you know, no, or words to the effect that there was going to be no assistance, and you thought that was because of Fannie and Freddie, and then you also mentioned AIG. Did you mean Bear Stearns?
I'm sorry, I did mean Bear Stearns.
Okay.
AIG was being discussed because everyone, most people understood it that there was an issue at AIG, but that's exactly right, it was Bear Stearns.
Mm-hmm. And now, my understanding is that, you know, there were three groups, you know, the various executives that were gathered were put into three groups to work on different parts of figuring out a resolution for Lehman. What group were you in?
I think I was in the liquid securities group.
And is that the group that was trying to figure out the values of the real estate assets, or is what group is that?
I think that group was the Credit Suisse Goldman group. I really don't recall.
Okay.
But I know they were in a different group.
Okay. We have, understanding that, we've heard from other folks that, you know, differing accounts on what the value of the assets were, that B of A or Barclays was unwilling to purchase. What's your understanding of that?
I have no understanding of that.
Okay.
I still don't know why BofA walked away, my guess is because they became more interested in Merrill Lynch. And I don't know what happened with Barclays. I can only tell you what I've heard after the fact, but at the moment I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. So when do the folks there learn that B of A is no longer in the running?
I want to say Saturday, but I don't know if it was Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon.
Okay. When you guys first show up on Friday and are addressed by Paulson and the others that, you know, a private sector solution is necessary, what was the discussions amongst the private sector folk? Did people think that was true, or did they think it was a negotiating tactic or something else?
I don't think anyone thought it was a negotiating tactic. I think people were just trying to figure out, how much money could you put up to help a competitor, and what impact would it have on your own firm?
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned before after the fact, I guess you heard about why the Barclays deal fell through. Before you tell us that, describe to us when you find out over the weekend that the Barclays deal wasn't going to happen.
I want to say Sunday midday.
Mm-hmm. And
or late morning.
And what happens? And what are you told?
What I recall was that either the FSA or the Bank of England required a shareholders' vote for Barclays to move forward. I think that's what I remember.
Mm-hmm. Now you had mentioned that there was discussion about, well, if the private sector works out a deal for Lehman, you know, what about Merrill? Because there was discussion about Merrill. Was there discussion about Morgan Stanley or Goldman?
No.
Okay. Was there, I will tell you that others we have talked to have said, you know, if Lehman went down, we were concerned that that would just be the beginning and that other investment banks would go down. Was there discussion about that during the weekend?
Probably, but no one was specific. The only specific name was Merrill. I think both Lloyd and myself knew that if Merrill went down, we would be in the sight of problems the next day or the next morning or whenever it happened. And as Lloyd said, he kept saying, you know, if you go down, I'm 20 seconds behind you. So that was not discussed openly. That was discussed, I'm sure, individually.
Mm-hmm. And just so the record's clear, when you say Lloyd, you mean Mr. Blankfein?
I do.
Thank you. Okay. So when the message is sent that the Barclays deal isn't going to go forward, what's the discussion at that point? I'll tell you that we have heard from several folks that, you know, there was there was discussion, apparently fairly heated, about you can't let this company fail. Do you recall any discussion along that regard? And if not, what do you recall after the message sent that the Barclays deal was dead?
I don't recall, Chris, any impassioned plea that you could not let this thing fail. I mean, I'm sure Dick Fold talked to Paulson and Geithner and the Nike, I assume. But I don't recall anyone in that room making that impassioned plea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Lehman files on Monday the 15th, very early in the morning. And as I think you know, folks other than me, but interviewed your treasurer, Mr. Wong. Could you walk us through, you know, generally what you recall about, you know, the impact of Lehman on Morgan Stanley? Let's at least start that week, the week of the 15th.
Well, look, I think the way it unfolded, it wasn't just Lehman. It was Lehman Merrill. And now we're the next in line. So clearly, we're worried about, number one, what's our exposure to Lehman Brothers, and can we get collateral that's with them back? What's our exposure, even though B of A is buying Merrill, but what's our exposure there? And now the issue, which you asked me much earlier, the issue of funding becomes a very big issue for us.
Mm-hmm. And how did funding become a big issue? What were the specifics of what occurred?
Well, we knew, again, let's go back to the end of 07 when we raised $5 billion, we began to get much more liquid in markets and probably went into the week, I would say, with around $150 billion of liquid securities, maybe $160 billion of liquid assets that we could convert very quickly, almost instantaneous, to cash. So we were prepared for clients to start withdrawing funds and suck liquidity. We thought we were prepared to see clients suck liquidity out of the firm. And that's exactly what happened.
And what, I mean, I think I know the answer, but let me ask you, what types of liquidity were getting sucked out of the firm? Was it on the repo side, commercial paper, the prime brokerage accounts? What was going on?
I think the biggest one was the prime brokerage, where people were taking, and shame on us, we actually let people take margin money out. We stopped that after a day or two. We wised up. But basically, taking their credit balances out was where was the most continuous draw, because we stopped the margin piece.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think we know, and Greg Philberg is here with me, and he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys tapped the PDCF, and we know Sunday night the Fed expanded the types of eligible collateral for the PDCF. Do you know, can you just, I guess, generally first describe for us, you know, the decisions to tap the PDCF and why it was done?
Well, we want to make sure if clients wanted their money out of the firm, their positions, that we'd give it to them. So that's why we were trying to build up liquidity. And we had securities that were accepted by the Fed, so we did it.
Okay. So I guess if you can, walk us through the remainder of the week. Like I said, we know that, you know, folks were withdrawing money and that you guys accessed the PDCF. When did, or did, liquidity issues calm down that week, or was it not until later?
It wasn't until later.
So I think I read somewhere that I think on the Tuesday following Lehman, you guys reported third quarter results. Does that sound familiar to you?
That's correct. We accelerated one day. I think on Monday our stock was really getting hit. I don't recall where it started and I don't recall where it ended, but it was getting hit. That we had really good earnings, and we thought if we accelerated that announcement, which I think we did Tuesday afternoon, I know we did it Tuesday, but I don't know if it's Tuesday morning or Tuesday afternoon. We reported earnings, and the stock continued to go down.
Okay.
So why do you think the good earnings were not reassuring to the market?
Hold on one second. I just think people saw a trend, and people just started selling our stock. People wanted to get short. They thought this was, an opportunity to get short the stock, and they did. One hedge fund manager said to me after the fact that he thought, this is way after the fact, like 6 or 7 months later, he thought pre-announcing earnings a day early was a sign of weakness. So I guess it was, because people certainly continued to short our stock or sell our stock. I don't know if they were shorting it, but they were certainly selling it.
Was there something bigger going on? Were the hedge funds just generally getting out of prime brokerage accounts and downsizing?
Well, a couple things. I think a number of the funds were concerned after Lehman bankruptcy, especially with funds in their prime brokerage business was getting locked up and they couldn't get their money out. So that frightened them. Number two, we were either, I think we were the largest prime broker on the street, so we had a lot of money of hedge funds. Number three, I think there were rumors of losses. The one I remember talking to a hedge fund manager about was that we had a $100 million loss, or a big loss, in HBOS, which was a rights offering in the UK, which was risky in the underwriting, but by the time that rumor was out there, we had gotten out of our position. We actually made $100 million. So you had that. And then, you know, it's pretty straightforward. If you look at a timeline on our repo desk, our financing desk, or our prime brokerage desk, somewhere around 2:45 in the afternoon, you would see our stock begin to go down. You would see CDS begin to widen out, so people were buying protection. And the Fed window closes at 3, and then, you know, in the next 20 minutes or 10 minutes, the clearing banks would say, you know, we see your stock price going down, your premiums on CDS going up. You need to post more collateral if you want us to clear for you. So that's what was going on.
So, and that you actually and perhaps anticipated one of my next questions, and that is, what was going on that week with the clearing bank for your tri-party repos? I take it they were asking at 20 minutes after 3 for more collateral?
They were. I don't know if all of them were, but I know they were.
Mm-hmm. Did Morgan Stanley post it, or were there disagreements, or explain to us what was going on?
The day we posted it.
Okay. Now, we know that, you know, once you, what I want you to do is walk us through through the end of the following weekend when, one, the company becomes a bank holding company, and two, it raises the $9 billion from Mitsubishi. There are at least reports in the books, and I think we've heard it in interviews and seen it in documents, that Paulson, Geithner, Bernanke, and others were pushing Morgan Stanley to find an acquisition partner. That obviously didn't happen, but the bank holding company and Mitsubishi Investment did. So could you just sort of walk us through the week following Lehman through the 21st and 22nd of September when those events occur?
Well, look, as soon as we come in on Monday, we know that we are in the eye of the storm with Merrill gone, Lehman gone. So we're doing a lot of things. We're reaching out to CIC, which had put the $5 billion in equity back in about a year ago. So we're talking to them. They actually fly to New York. We start negotiating with them. We talk to some of the other sovereign wealth funds around the world. We talk to Buffett. So we're looking for sources of liquidity and funding, and we do that wherever we think we can get sources of funding. So that's going on constantly that week. You know, the Chinese, I think, negotiated in good faith, but they were being told, I assume, by their advisors that, you know, I wouldn't put any money into these firms. They're in trouble. I can't prove that, but that's what I think. So we got a call, I don't remember if it was Thursday or Friday, from our Tokyo office that Mitsubishi would have interest in a major investment, and they would like to talk to the Morgan Stanley group Monday morning early their time, I think 6 a.m., which would be 5 p.m. our time Sunday. So that was being set up. And during that week, a number of conversations with Hank Paulson, trying to figure out a way of getting more stability within the company. Tim Geithner was persistent in pushing us to sell the company. And when we pre-announced earnings on that Tuesday, I got a call from Vikram Pandit, very complimentary about our earnings. Wednesday morning, I got a call from Steve Volk, I think the vice chairman at Citi, who said, great earnings, you know, we'd love to merge with you. And I got a call from Geithner, who said, call Jamie Dimon, he'll buy your firm. Something to that effect, not exactly those words. So that's Wednesday. The market, our stock continues to fall. we're worried about funding. We call and talking to leadership here. We should call city if they want to do something. I call Vikram. He says he is interested. I need to talk to my board, and 3 or 4 hours later comes back and says, I'm sorry, the board, given what's going on, does not want to do anything. I called Jamie. He said, John, I have no interest. And I said, well, Tim tells me you do. Well, he's wrong. I don't have any interest. So we had those conversations. I think that's Wednesday. On Thursday, and again, you got to cut me a break. I don't know if it's Wednesday, Thursday, but one of those days. My CFO and one of my presidents, James Gorman and Colin Kelleher, tell me that Jamie has talked to them, basically asking about the firm, how are we doing, and they thought it was clear for him to be calling them. There was a possibility he wanted to buy the firm. I called Jamie, chatted with him. He said, no, I'm just trying to be helpful. I said, well, if you want to be helpful, talk to me. Don't go around me. We had that conversation, and he made it very clear he had no interest in buying the firm. Let me just think for a second.
So when did the idea of a bank holding company come in?
Probably that week, Wednesday, Thursday, we started talking about it.
And who brought that up?
Internally, which I didn't know in the later, our internal crew with one of our advisors or maybe one of our lawyers brought it up. But my first conversation was actually in talking to Lloyd Blankfein.
And that was Wednesday or Thursday?
Me, do you think that would be helpful? And I said, in the long run, yes. In the short run, I don't know how you could get it done so quickly.
And that conversation was in the Wednesday-Thursday time frame?
Yes.
So did he call you?
I don't remember that. I mean, we talked a number of times. I just can't remember who made the calls.
So the context of the conversations was that you're both facing a similar problem?
Yeah, look, it was a domino effect. I mean, I think if Morgan Stanley went out of business, all the attention would have turned to Goldman Sachs. Even without Morgan Stanley going out of business, you know, he was losing liquidity and his stock price was going down.
Mm-hmm. So you were up to Wednesday, Thursday, and we know the bank holding company gets done, I think, on the 21st, and the capital raise with Mitsubishi, I think, gets announced the next day, but I assume was done the day before. So can you just walk us...
21st is Sunday?
Yes.
Okay. I agree with that.
Yeah. So can you just walk us through the rest of the week leading up to the 21st?
Well, we'd called our board in for the weekend, so they arrived Saturday, and we had a number of updates for them. We talked about... what was going on. We talked about Mitsubishi, the conversation we were going to have. I think on that Saturday, Paulson called me to say that he thought the time was running out and we needed to come up with a solution and maybe I should try to find a merger partner. I told him that we were going to have a conversation with the Japanese, and I felt confident that they were going to do this transaction of putting $9 billion into us. He said, come on, John, you and I both know the Japanese could not make a decision that quickly. I pushed back and said, no, I don't know that. I believe they will. We have done a hostile takeover for them on one of the banks they own a big piece of here in the U.S., I think it's Union Bank.
Right.
The Japanese were a great client. Once they made up their mind, they followed through, and I said that to Hank. And Hank and I agreed to disagree. That was on Saturday. Not a lot happened on Sunday, on Saturday night. And then we start Sunday. Again, board comes in about midday. We're trying other means of where we can find investors out of the Middle East. We're also looking. But in actuality, we are just waiting for the 5 p.m. call to Tokyo. And since you've read the books, you know the story.
Right.
We're sitting around basically waiting. At about 4 o'clock, 4:30, my secretary walks in and says, "Hank Paulson's on the phone." And when I pick up the phone, they're about, I don't know, I got a couple board of directors in there, outside consultants, lawyers, and a lot of my management team. And Hank said that Ben Bernanke and Tim Geithner were on the phone and they wanted to talk to me. And I said, "Well, I would like to put my general counsel on," which I did. And basically, they said they wanted me to sell the firm.
Right. And the books also say, and what we've heard other than the books, was that one of the concerns you had about doing a deal with whoever it may have been, the books indicate it's still J.P. Morgan at that point, would have been that a lot of Morgan Stanley employees would have lost their jobs. So I guess I have two questions. One, was J.P. Morgan actually still a possible acquirer of the firm on Saturday or Sunday, and certainly Sunday when Secretary Paulson calls? And if so, what were their discussions about, you know, what would happen in terms of layoffs of Morgan Stanley folk?
The conversations I had with Jamie and about that, this is prior to the weekend, he was very clear. He said, "I don't know why Tim continues to tell you I want to buy the firm. I do not. I'm going to call him and tell him I do not want to buy it. I will tell him again," he said. And he said, "John, even if I were forced to buy it, I would only pay a dollar or two for the firm." We did not talk about layoffs because it was very clear in that conversation he didn't want to buy the firm. So we never had that conversation. But my view was that when you have 45 or 50,000 people and they've already done the Bear Stearns transaction, there's a lot of overlap, that there would have been, you know, maybe half the firm would have been laid off.
Mm-hmm.
But we never had that conversation.
Mm-hmm. So I take it after the Paulson call on Sunday, since that was at 4:30, less than an hour later you have the call with Mitsubishi.
That's correct.
And I take it that was a positive call.
That's also correct.
Okay. Now there's been report, I think this is in the books too, that while we know now that Mitsubishi put in the $9 billion, at the time they were reportedly looking with J.P. Morgan at acquiring Morgan Stanley completely. Were there discussions like that with Mitsubishi at all?
This has been an interesting call. It's the first time I've heard that today.
I must have misread it.
Okay. I'm not aware of that.
Okay. So walk us through, you had mentioned earlier that when you were talking to Mr. Blankfein about becoming a bank holding company, that one of the things you said was, "I don't know how it could get done quick enough," or words to that effect. It did get done that quick enough. So walk us through how that occurred.
I can't do that. You got to ask the Fed that. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, we worked on it. We had a whole team on it. But how it moves so quickly, that's something they have to answer.
When did Morgan Stanley first contact the Fed about becoming a bank holding company?
This is not a specific guarantee, but I would have thought Thursday.
Okay.
So I mean, so what benefits did you see in becoming a bank holding company at that point?
I think the biggest benefit, it would show you that that you're important to the system. And the Fed would not make you a holding company if they thought in a very short period of time you'd be out of business. I think it was really signaling more than anything else.
So, there weren't any specific programs at this point. You already had liquidity programs you could access through the Fed, so there weren't any specific short-term gains you could get. Is that correct?
Well, we had access to certain securities with the Fed, and as you know, they continue to open up the breadth of which of assets you could put into them. But it wasn't so much that, it was more of a statement that if the Fed were to make a Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley Bank holding company, send a signal that these two firms are going to survive.
Mm-hmm. When you had the call with Mitsubishi on Sunday, or in any other conversations with Mitsubishi, anything said about whether the government would essentially make sure their investment wasn't lost?
No.
Okay. You had mentioned that earlier in midweek you had talked to Mr. Blankfein about the issue of becoming a bank holding company. Of course, we've read in the books and I think heard otherwise that there were also discussions about the ban on short selling, and I think you folks issued a press release like on September 19th, I guess, which would have been the Friday, I think that essentially said, thank you, SEC, for banning short selling. Can you walk us through that?
Well, that started over the weekend before when Lehman went out of business. Four or five of us sat around, and I said, look, I think one of the things to get through this, there should be a ban on short selling. Everyone agreed but Lloyd, Blankfein. And then on Monday, on Tuesday, he called me and said, look, I was wrong. You're right, there should be a temporary ban on short selling. And I think it was very clear, but of course no one wanted to hear that. These were extraordinary times, and I think the combination of credit derivatives with a short sell kind of put the short sell on steroids. So we had that conversation, and I think there was an article in the Wall Street Journal either on Tuesday or Wednesday that clearly quotes me or talks about me, but I think Lloyd also was mentioned in that article, saying there should be a temporary ban on short selling. And again, I'm a believer in short selling, but I think in extraordinary times, and this was one of them, and given the impact of credit derivatives, that this was a time there should have been a hiatus put on it. I don't know why Commissioner Cox added about 600 stocks instead of maybe 50 stocks, but he did. And I had a number of conversations with him, and he told me that academic studies show that short selling has no impact in the sense of either keeping a company in business or out of business. And he used the term in normal times, and I told him this is not a normal time. So I don't think I had any impact on him on that. I think Secretary Paulson talked to him. I don't know that for a fact, but that is my recollection. And I think he did have an impact, finally, on Chris Cox.
So were there any discussions during Lehman weekend with federal officials about a ban on short selling?
I don't recall with Fed officials, no.
Okay.
Possibly, but I don't know that. Okay. I mean, I just don't know.
And then,
I mean, I don't.
Sure. And then did you have any conversations or any Morgan Stanley people have conversations with federal officials that have been on short selling prior to your conversation with Mr. Blankfein on, I think you said the 16th, I think you said that was? I'm sorry, I'm getting the dates mixed up.
Tuesday. I don't know what date Tuesday is. I don't have a calendar in front of me. I can't definitively say, but I would have thought so. I mean, I felt strongly about it, so it wouldn't have been unusual for me to have had a conversation, most likely with Paulson, but possibly with Geithner. But I think Hank was the person I would have spoken to.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that Chairman Cox was saying, you know, academic studies show, although he concedes they're for normal times. What was the response from Paulson and any of the other federal officials you were talking to?
They didn't tell me what they said to each other. I don't know.
No, I understand that. What did they tell you? Like, for example, when you talked to former Secretary Paulson about, hey, I think there should be a ban on short selling, what was his response?
Oh, he was in agreement with me. He agreed with that.
Okay. Did you talk to any, other than Cox and Paulson, did you talk to any other federal officials?
You know, I know I talked to Hank Paulson. Mm-hmm. I may have spoken to Tim Geithner. I did not talk to Ben Bernanke, to my recollection. But I think most of the conversation was with Hank.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So on Sunday, you get the bank holding company application done. You get the $9 billion from Mitsubishi. Did that calm things down? Did that solve the funding problems that you had the previous week?
Well, we still had a lot of volatility, but it did, yes.
Okay, and I don't know, and maybe Greg sitting here does, but did you continue to access the PDCF that following week, do you recall?
I don't recall, but I'm sure we did.
Okay. Now, we know moving forward that during that week, both WaMu goes down on the 25th, and that apparently triggers somewhat of a liquidity run on Wachovia, and then they get a deal done over the weekend initially was Citi, and of course then it becomes the Wells Fargo deal. I believe I've seen somewhere reports that Wachovia may have, you know, talked to you folks about a potential deal. Is that the case?
That is the case. We did speak, but we could not get our hands around some of their positions. What's the right word? Very complicated. We just couldn't get enough information.
Okay, and just generally, who did you talk to and when?
Well, generally, I didn't talk to anyone. I made the initial call to Bob Steele, and then it was Bob Scully and a team of bankers who talked and met with Wachovia.
Okay. Now, going further into the next few weeks, eventually the government gets the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, passed. And then further down the road, my understanding is anyway that folks get summoned to D.C., folks from the nine biggest banks, and are told, please take TARP. Or you're going to take TARP. And then, of course, we know Morgan Stanley, I think it's $10 billion later in October. Can you just walk us through, when did you go to the meeting in D.C., and then walk us through what happened?
Okay. Again, I don't have a calendar, but I think on the 28th was one of the days of the World Bank meeting in Washington. I was there. And I get a call from Secretary Paulson. He says, can you be in my office or in the Treasury building on Monday, I think at 3 o'clock? I told him yes. I asked him, could you tell me what this is about? He said, John, I'm calling some people in. I'm not told anyone. Just come to my office. And I told him I'd be there. And I showed up. And I think when I walked into the conference room, yeah, the CEO of State Street was there. I think Ken Lewis was there. And then over the next 5 minutes, all nine banks were there. That was in the conference room in the Treasury. And then sitting across from the bank leadership was Paulson, Bernanke, Geithner, Sheila Bair, John Dugan. They were at the table, and then, there were people in the chairs behind them. The only person, I'm not going to guess. I want to say Terry Checkey was there, but I don't know. I think he was there.
So what's said?
Hank Paulson said, I want to make sure that the system is sound. That's not his words. Those are my words. We have talked to your regulators, and we have come up with equity infusions we would like you to take. He said, I know some of you are going to say you don't need it, but I want you all to take it. So that was the discussion. And then at some point in that discussion, they lay out how much each bank will get. So as an example, since B of A was buying Merrill, they wanted B of A to take $15 billion. They wanted Merrill to take $10 for $25. And Citi, JP, and Wells, I think, would each take $25. Goldman and Morgan would take $10. State Street, someone else. I don't know, maybe the Bank of New York, if they were there, it would take less than that, like three or four. I don't remember the exact number. And the biggest pushback came from Wells. The CEO there was pretty outspoken that he didn't want to take it, and didn't think it made sense. Someone made the comment, these are attractive terms, we should take it. So there's a back and forth. I don't remember which leader said what, but it was very clear as we moved further into the meeting. I think it was Chairman Bernanke made some comment like, to the gist, we're not trying to be heavy-handed and force this on you. We think it's the right thing for the system. Hank Paulson interrupted and said, no, I am being heavy-handed. If you turn this TARP money down and your regulator determines going forward that you need to raise equity, and you go on the market and cannot raise equity and you come back to this office, you're going to be punished. With that, I reached across the table from Tim Geithner. I took the piece of paper, I signed my name, and flipped it across to Tim and said, we're in. He said, you didn't put the name down or the amount. I said, you can do that. It's Morgan Stanley. And then someone said, aren't you going to take this to your board? I said, well, I don't have to. I think the board will go along with it. I will take it to them, but we're committed to it. And if they're unhappy with me, they can fire me. And that might be a happy day for me. That's what I said.
And obviously your board agreed subsequently.
Yep. Yep. And if you remember, Vikram Panda and I were the first to leave because the board said absolutely yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. In my view, and of course everyone took the money, mm-hmm. only a fool would turn that money down.
Mm-hmm. So other than Mr. Kovacevic, were others, I mean, you said he was the most vocally opposed. Were others opposed?
You know, some people talked about it, but not with the force that Dick came across with.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you say you'd be a fool to not take it if you, you've just gotten a big equity injection?
Because when one of the senior officials say to you, if you cannot raise equity based on a test that your regulator gives you and you come back to me, you're going to be punished. That's why.
So they could set the terms.
That's how I read it. I mean, they didn't say that, but that's the only way you could read it.
So this is interesting. These have only been your regulator for 2 weeks. I mean, so in a sense, this is tied to your becoming a bank holding company.
Say that again, please.
Well, the Fed had only been your regulator for 2 weeks. So in a sense, your being in the room was a function of having changed your status and becoming a bank holding company? And do you believe you would have been invited if you were still an independent investment bank?
Yes.
So it was a systemic concern about the size of the institution?
Yeah, I think it was about the size. It was systemic. I think that anyone in that room, they viewed as an important cog in soundness and stability, and they wanted him in the room. So, my view, we'd have been invited anyway.
Mm-hmm. So let me go to the more broader 30,000-foot level questions, and that is, I'd like to get your opinions on what you see as the primary causes of the financial crisis. I have looked at the written statement you gave us back in January when you testified and looked at what you said during, or what you testified to during the hearing. So I do know that, but I'd still like to get your views on that so we have them for the record.
Sure. Well, look, I don't have my statement in front of me, but there was no one event or issue or security that caused this. And even though I'm not the biggest fan of Mr. Gasparino, I think his book Sell-Off really tracks the history of how we've gotten here over the last 35 plus years. So it was a combination of too much leverage. It was a combination, and too much leverage, not just with the banks, but with consumers, with credit cards. So leverage in the system, I think there was too much leverage. It was too easy to get credit. So I think that was an issue. I think, including Morgan Stanley, we should have had much more robust risk systems. And I think one of the things that I find a huge positive in reporting to the Fed is their ability to come in and test your models and work with you on your risk oversight. That has been helpful. I mean, it's cumbersome and it's slow, but it's helpful. It's very helpful. So risk management clearly is something that we could have done a better job on, and that's more focused on the banks versus me talking about consumers earlier. I think complexity had something to do with it. So that was a part of it. And then we got too comfortable with some of the illiquid assets, whether you want to call leverage lending illiquid assets, or whether you want to call some of the real estate, not just residential, but commercial real estate. Clearly, we got in a position, I thought, firms were in illiquid assets, and that was a mistake in looking back. I would also say that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how aggressive Freddie and Fannie were in continuing to issue mortgages, and over time, the erosion of some of the quality of those loans, and then add to that, you know, it became a fee generator for the industry to get rid of the mortgages very quickly, and there was no residual left on some of the balance sheets. And I think, you know, everything tied together played a role in this. There's no one thing.
So specifically, too, I mean, we over here we've been thinking about the crisis as the bubble, the housing bubble on the one hand, and kind of the financial crisis on the other hand. And we're looking for kind of sources of financial instability. So one of them is maybe the repo market. Another one is maybe the derivatives market. I mean, to what extent was the system fragile, and what could have been done about it?
Well, the issue there is that by the time you know, a light didn't go off 2 years prior to this and say, this is the track you're on. I think the light, again, I point to Gasparino's book. This evolved over a long period of time, and it was incremental. So to pick a point in time and say, boy, you should have blown the whistle, and you got to think, you know, if you're a lending officer, you probably never made a mortgage loan in a residential house you lost money on, so people got more and more aggressive. So again, I don't think there's a moment in time I could point to that.
So you mentioned you didn't have your statement in front of you, but you said several things that are actually in your statement from January, where you also said too much leverage, too much risk, not good enough risk management. And of course, during that hearing, Chairman Angelides brought up that you were quoted, of course, you probably heard it a gazillion times, in that Bloomberg article back in November of 2009 about, you know, we can't control ourselves, you have to step in and control the street. But given that comment and given your other you know, descriptions of cause of the financial crisis, why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think there was too much leverage and too much risk and not good enough risk management? And why do you think that, you know, you do need someone to step in and prevent excessive risk-taking?
Well, the excessive risk-taking goes to a conversation that I had with Tim Geithner. I think this is in the fourth quarter of 2007. We had committed to a private equity firm to lend them money for a takeover at 8x leverage. We were somewhat uncomfortable, but again, a very competitive business. All of our major competitors were involved in it. And once the private equity firm had everyone committed, they came back and took it up to 10x leverage. At that time, we chose to drop out of the syndicate. So I called Tim Geithner and said, Tim, I'm a big boy. If I miss a piece of business, I miss a piece of business. But let me tell you what just happened. And I said, you know, it's clear that it's so competitive and everyone is looking at revenues and how do you build a business that people are taking more and more risk. And I can pass on this deal, which I just did, and I can pass on the next one and maybe on the third one. But if I pass on the fourth or the fifth one, you're going to have people possibly leaving. You're going to have business going away from you. And that's when I said, I don't think we can control ourselves. At some point, you need to step in. And his comment to me was, Well, not to make you feel any better, the bank that took your place at 10 times leverage just called a complaint also. So why is that? I think it's when you get on the road. If you got on the road early on and you rode this thing up over the last 3 or 4 years, you probably made a lot of money. But if you got on the road in the last half mile, you got your shirt handed to you. And the only person, I believe, since these are public entities and people are looking at profits, I think regulators have to have a more active role. And one of the things I like about the Fed and I like about Dodd-Frank is a more active role. And I just want to add one other thing. I'm glad I said the same thing that I said in my written report, and I don't have it in front of me, so that's encouraging.
Yeah, I would have pointed that out.
Thank you.
Although I will point out one thing that you also said in the written testimony that we haven't covered yet, at least not exactly, and that is you also mentioned the lack of tools by regulators. So I don't know. I mean, it's been now several hours since I read back the transcript in your testimony, so I don't know if you went into detail, but if you could tell us what you meant by that, if you recall.
Yeah, well, I don't know specifically, but I think one of the things that I don't think the regulators are really in touch with each other. I mean, I can't say that about all of them. I think communication between regulators is very important, not just domestically, but on a global basis. I think the concept of having the Treasury as the lead regulator and a council of regulators so they meet on a regular basis and talk about the system is very helpful. That did not occur, at least formally in a formal manner in the past. I think going forward that's a huge positive. I think it's a huge positive that the Federal Reserve probably has 110, 120 people who come to work every day at Morgan Stanley and we report to the Fed, I think is a huge positive. I think that having a derivatives, either clearinghouse or exchange for some of these instruments is a positive. So that may have been what I was referring to as tools, is really communication and working together to have the whole picture of a financial institution versus a slice of the picture.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned, this goes back to one of the things you mentioned on Lehman Weekend, where, you know, one of your main concerns was, what's our exposure? And one of the things we've been looking at here, that the statute tells us to, is the role of derivatives. And one of the things we've been looking in that regard was, you know, they weren't the most transparent things in the world to the outside world because they weren't on an exchange, they weren't regulated. But I'm wondering, you know, obviously within the companies, I suspect there's more transparency, but I'm wondering about how much. What did you guys know about your exposures to Lehman during that weekend and around that time?
Well, I think we knew what our exposures were. The problem was sometimes to clear securities, you put securities into the financing machine apparatus, and you don't get the answer immediately. It could be the next day. So I'll give you an example. On Wednesday, after Lehman was bankrupt, my CFO came into my office and said, "John, we're going to be out of money on Friday." And I said, "That can't be. I know we went in with about $160 billion. That's impossible." He says, "No, we're going to be out of money on Friday." And I said, "Well, intuitively, you're wrong. Go to the financing desk, follow the trail, and come back to me." And 2 hours later, he came back, and he said, "Yeah, you're right. We will get $40 billion back tomorrow. It's sometimes you have to put up collateral to clear collateral, and then you get it back." So even though we knew where we were, we didn't know when we were going to get it back. And if it got locked up, as it did with some people at Lehman, then you have a real issue.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned when I asked you about, you know, after the Barclays deal, after folks learned that the Barclays deal had fallen through, that you didn't recall whether or not there was any, I think you said, impassioned plea to keep Lehman from failing. At least with the benefit of hindsight now, seeing certainly what how it impacted Morgan Stanley the following weekend, seeing how it impacted everything else in terms of markets. Do you think there should have been an impassioned plea? Do you have any views on whether or not Lehman was quote-unquote too big to fail?
Well, I think the answer is in the aftermath. I mean, even though it's been very painful, and I feel for Dick Fuld and all of his employees, it didn't bring the system down, and it really held people accountable. So I would have to say that letting one of the firms go down didn't bring the whole system down, and created clearly fear in the marketplace of other participants on how they needed to be much more diligent in the way they managed and controlled and measured risk. So, look, again, I feel very much for the employees and I feel for the investors, but on a pure nuts and bolts, cold-hearted analysis, it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we've had other folks that we've talked to, at least a couple anyway, tell us that they thought that, you know, even if Lehman would have been provided government assistance, that there still would have been, you know, very large disruptions in the markets and reverberations to other companies. Do you have any views on that?
I would think they're right.
I mean, just in terms of various government policies that were put in place, how effective were? Well, I guess one would be the short selling ban that we talked about. Was that helpful when it was finally put in place by the SEC?
Yeah, I think if you go back and you track when that was put in place, you would see it was helpful, and then track when it came off, and you got a lot more volatility.
Okay. And how about the Fed liquidity programs? Were they helpful to the to your company and other companies throughout 2008, and especially after Lehman?
I think they were helpful, and I also think they helped calm the markets.
So a lot of other causes of that. I mean, another issue that people bring up is mark-to-market accounting. How important do you think that was in this in the way the crisis played out?
Well, look, not being a bank holding company at the time, we mark to market. We believe in marking to market. But if everyone marked to market, the outcome would still be the same.
Mr. Mack, thank you very much for your time. We don't have any more questions. I appreciate your time
thanks,
very
guys.
Much.
All right, guys.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
All right.
Thanks.